A certain Boy Scout master was determined that his scouts would be ready for the next court of honor. So he ordered that each one of them do some good deed over the next week so that they would be prepared for that following meeting. When they gathered at the next meeting, the scout master asked the first boy, "What good deed did you do over the past week?" He said, "Well, I helped a little old lady cross the street." Scoutmaster said, That's good, very good." So he turned to the next boy and he said, "What good deed did you do over the past week?" He said, "I helped him help the little old lady cross the street." "I see," said the scoutmaster. He turned to the next boy and he said, "What was your good deed?" He said, "Well, I helped those two help the little old lady across the street." Well, frowning at that time, the scoutmaster looked at the fourth boy and asked what his good deed was. And he said, "Well, I helped the other three guys help the little old lady cross the street." And the scoutmaster was obviously a little upset. And he said, "Why did it take four of you guys to help one little lady cross the street?" And the fourth scout replied, "Because she didn't want to cross the street." Some people have difficulty accepting the help of others. I don't know that that's what the focus was there, but that is a fact, that some people are too independent-minded. They're too strong-willed. They want to go it alone. They don't like assistance and help from other people. In some respects, America was built on an independent spirit, commonly called rugged individualism. Some of us have perhaps had it drilled into our heads that we should pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, that we stand on our own, that we should never depend on anybody for anything. If this kind of attitude is taken to an extreme, it can have a devastating impact negatively on individuals and on society. A lot of people think that this idea is taught in the Bible, and I understand that there's the fact that we are accountable for our actions, for our deeds, for our choices. But in its fully unveiled sense, I don't believe that philosophy is taught in the Bible. In fact, in reality, every single one of us not only needs the Lord, but we also need each other. Few of us would last very long at all without the help and without the assistance of other people. When you think about simple fact of what we eat, how we sustain ourselves physically in a variety of ways, staying warm, water supply, all this depends on other people and other efforts. Sometimes people justify their independence by saying, "Well, you know, the Bible says that God helps those who help themselves." Well, like a lot of other things that are supposedly in the Bible, that statement is not found anywhere in Scripture. In fact, the Bible teaches the opposite in the full sense of the meaning. God waits to assist those who finally come to the point in their lives where they realize and accept that they cannot help themselves, and they willingly surrender themselves to a loving God. As long as man thinks that he can fix things, as long as man thinks that he can pull himself up by his own bootstraps, he's going to think that he does not need God. And if we don't accept our dependence on God, we ultimately find ourselves fighting against him. Sometime around 1050 BC, when the Israelites wanted a king so they could be like the nations around them, in 1 Samuel chapter 8 through chapter 12, their problem was much deeper than just the name that they would call their ruler, that is, a king. Their problem was much deeper than the form of government that they were choosing. That is, a monarchy. And though it was part of the problem, their problem was much deeper than simply wanting to be like others. I'm going to read a few sections of those passages I mentioned. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses... I'll just begin with verse 1 through 9. It says, "It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel." It mentions the name of the first and then the second. And it says, but it's verse 3, "His sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They took bribes and perverted justice." Verse 4, sorry. "Then all the elders of Israel gathered together." And came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "Look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways." "Look, you're old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make for us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you. For they've not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them." Chapter 10, verses 17 through 19, the narrative continues. Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah, said to the children of Israel, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up out of Egypt, delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians, from the hand of all the kingdoms, and from those who oppressed you. But you have today rejected your God, who himself saved you out of all your adversities and your tribulations. And you said to him, 'No, but set a king over us.' Now therefore present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans." When Saul is finally brought forth in chapter 12, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Samuel said to all Israel, 'Indeed, I have heeded your voice and all that you've said to me, have made a king over you. Now here is the king walking before you, and I am old and gray-headed, and look, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my childhood to this day. Here I am. Witness against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I received any bribe with which to blind my eyes? I'll restore it to you.' They denied all of these things." Verse 5, then he said, "The Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day that you have not found anything in my hand." And they answered, "He is witness." Samuel said to the people, "It is the Lord who raised up Moses and Aaron. It is the Lord who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt. Now therefore stand still that I may reason with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous acts of the Lord which he did to you and your fathers." Might ask at this point, why is he going through this? He's just supposed to be setting forth this king, but he's going through this history, and he's already done it just previously. But he says, verse 7, "Stand still that I may reason with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous acts of the Lord which he did to you and your fathers. When Jacob had gone into Egypt and the fathers cried out to the Lord, then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. When they forgot the Lord their God, he sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, into the hand of the Philistines, into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. Then they cried out to the Lord and said, 'We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and served the Baals and Ashtoreths, but now deliver us from the hand of our enemies, and we will serve you.' And the Lord sent Jerubbaal, Baadan, Jephthah, Samuel, delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you dwelt in safety. And when you saw that Nabash, Nahash, king of the Ammonites, came against you. You said to me, no, but a king shall rule over us when the Lord your God was your king. And then he says, now therefore here is your king, and he continues. But note Samuel's line of reasoning. He's pointing out that God had continually demonstrated his ability. God had continually demonstrated his willingness, his desire to handle all the problems that Israel ever encountered. So why were they wanting a king? Were they wanting a king again just so that they would have somebody that they could call a king? Were they wanting this in order to be a monarchy? Were they wanting this just to be like the other nations? We'd kind of like to be like those guys over there. Now, it's pointed out clearly in the text that Israel's problem was rejection of God. Israel's problem was a lack of dependence on God. A textile mill had large signs displayed throughout the work area. The signs said, when your thread becomes tangled, call the foreman. A young woman was new on her job and her thread became tangled, and she thought, like many of us do, I'll just try to straighten this out myself first. She tried and things got worse, and so she finally calls the foreman over and she says, I did the best I could. He said, no, you didn't. If you'd done the best you could, you would have called me over immediately. Depending on others is a hard thing for many of us to do. Depending on God is a hard thing for many of us to do. Deuteronomy chapter 8. This is titled Israel in the Wilderness. Now this is after the fact, but it's looking back up on that time period. Deuteronomy chapter 8. I'm going to read verses 1 through 18. The text says, every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you. He allowed you to hunger. He fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. Your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. So you should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines, figs, pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron, out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you this day, lest when you've eaten and are full, have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and your gold are multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness in which there were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the rock of flint, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, that he might test you to do you good in the end. Then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth, And you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. You shall remember the Lord your God. How many things could each of us attribute to our own pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps, to our own wisdom, to our own intellect, to our own ability, to our own street wiseness, cleverness? As we look back through our lives, the things we've done, the things we've accomplished, do we tend to think that way? Do we tend to think like Israel thought, and as is being depicted here, that they will likely do? For 40 years, Israel was fed every day by the hand of God, bread from heaven, manna. Why? So they could be impressed by God's ability to do this. Every morning they get up and they say, wow, look at that. That is impressive. That's astonishing. Just like yesterday. Was it just so they could fill their bellies, so they could sustain themselves? Verse 3 again says, he humbled you and allowed you to hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. It was to teach them dependence upon God. He cared for them. He sustained them. He blessed them ultimately by giving them the land, by giving them houses they hadn't built. Not to just give them things, like the teachings of Joel Osteen and other materialistic messengers, but to help them learn to depend on God, to help them learn that God is faithful and that God can be depended on to supply their needs. Someone has said, man, despite his artistic pretensions, his sophistication, and his many accomplishments, man owes the fact of his existence to a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains. Now, I realize that this leaves God entirely out of the picture, but I think the point is still powerful. Man on his own is a very dependent creature, even if you're just considering the sustaining of his physical life. His entire existence can be wiped out in a matter of weeks without a simple source of food. The tiniest traces of chemical elements, certain chemicals, can snuff out a man's existence in a matter of moments. Man is fragile. Man is a very dependent creature who often tries to convince himself and others of how strongly independent he is. A man named Saul, New Testament Saul, not the Old Testament Saul King, but Saul of Tarsus. What a humbling experience it must have been for this man named Saul to become a Christian. A man who no doubt was quite proud of himself. I really don't know a lot about his attitude, his character, his disposition prior to becoming a Christian, but he states his pedigree, if you will, in Philippians chapter 3, verses 3 through 7. He says, at this time, we put no confidence in human effort, though I could have confidence in my own effort if anyone could. I was circumcised when I was 8 days old. I'm a pure-blooded citizen of Israel and a member of the tribe of Benjamin, a real Hebrew if there ever was one. I was a member of the Pharisees who demand the strictest obedience to the Jewish law. He goes on in verse 6 and says, as for righteousness, I obeyed the law without fault. I once thought these things were valuable, but now I consider them worthless, counting it all as garbage. What a humbling experience having to face the fact that all of those things which had meant so much to him previously were now meaningless before God. Having to learn that he had in fact been fighting the very cause, the very purpose, the very people of God. Having to learn to humble himself before the very people that he had persecuted. I picture Saul as being someone with quite an independent spirit, someone who had a lot of confidence in himself. Imagine the humiliating experience a few years after he submitted to the Lord, when the Jews of the city of Damascus decided to put out a contract on him. The mighty hunter now became the hunted. The Jews wanted him so badly that they posted guards at every gate around Damascus. Imagine the fear. Imagine the sense of helplessness that Saul must have felt. Acts chapter 9, verse 25 says, his followers took him by night and lowered him in a basket through an opening in the wall. Who came to Saul's rescue? Rich, powerful men. They're simply identified as his followers, his disciples. We don't even know them by name, but Saul did. Can you imagine the great Saul of Tarsus, who knows how high up he was going to climb, 5 years earlier saying, sure, I'll get in a basket. Nothing like a little basket rescue to help teach a little dependence. This is the same man who proudly and perhaps arrogantly led a group of men in the glaring light of noonday openly and brazenly to Damascus just a few years earlier to hunt down Christians. He's now sneaking out of the city in a basket in the middle of the night by the aid of some of those same people that he had been hunting. Imagine the humbling experience of Paul then going to Jerusalem, where he had previously been a big shot, seeking to join himself to a little ragtag group of Christians whom again he had previously been trying to destroy. Wasn't Jerusalem the headquarters of the Jewish opposition? In our vernacular, you might say that Saul had owned Jerusalem previously. Maybe a bit of a stretch, but you get the point. It's where his alma mater was. He knew Jerusalem like the back of his hand. He knew everyone of significance in the city. And he's going there to be a part of this little group of believers. Acts 9:26 tells us when he came to Jerusalem, he tried to join the disciples, but they were all afraid of him, not believing that he was really a disciple. So, the Christians in Jerusalem didn't want to have anything to do with him. And we see a little bit later that the Jews were again trying to kill him here. Christians were afraid of him, and they had good reason. He'd imprisoned and killed some of their friends and relatives. Here was a man with all his former glory now gone, a man whom nobody wanted to have anything to do with. Have you ever felt the sting of that kind of rejection? Have you ever felt like a person that nobody wanted anything to do with? It's a hard place to be. But it's a place where we often learn the most about depending on God. Saul had to realize that he knew nothing of what he thought he'd known. Saul had to learn to put his trust in God, not in the power of the Sanhedrin, not in the strength of friends. He had to recognize that he was dependent on God for his safety. He was dependent on God for his very life. He had to learn this again and again. In fact, years later, He wrote to the Corinthians concerning another occasion like this. He said in 2 Corinthians 1, verses 8 and 9, "We think you ought to know, dear brothers and sisters, about the trouble that we went through in the province of Asia. We were crushed, we were overwhelmed beyond our ability to endure, and we thought we would never live through it. In fact, we expected to die. But as a result, we stopped relying on ourselves and learned to rely on God who raises the dead." Depend on is a synonym for rely on. The contemporary English version said this made us stop trusting in ourselves and start trusting in God. And so when you break it down, failure or refusal to recognize our need for, to recognize our dependence upon God, is a failure or a refusal to rely on God, which is a failure or refusal to trust in God, which is in essence a failure or refusal to believe God. In practical ways, how do we go about depending on the Lord? How do we trust Him? When I say we need to put our trust in the Lord, when I say that we need to learn to depend upon the Lord, I'm not talking about making wrong or foolish choices while saying God will make it all work out. I'm not talking about doing nothing while saying I'm just leaving it all up to God. I'm talking about making the best choices we can while doing the best we can, yet trusting God that no matter how bad things look, He is going to make them work out for our spiritual best. This is where Romans 8:28 is so often abused. That passage, "All things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purposes. This is, again, where the charlatans of the name it and claim it so-called gospel, or the health and wealth so-called gospel, sometimes called prosperity theology, say that it means that if you just trust God, you're going to get that car that you want, and the house that you want, and the job that you want, and the girl that you want, and all those other things that you want. But that's what that passage means. Well, that's quite interesting in view of the fact that the Apostle Paul, who wrote that passage and who clearly trusted in God, had a storyline that doesn't read like that at all. He says, "I've been in prison more frequently than these other people. I've been flogged more severely, exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one." We know that account. 3 times beaten with rods, pelted with stones, shipwrecked day and night in the open sea, constantly on the move, in danger from rivers, from bandits, from fellow Jews, from Gentiles in the city, in the country, in danger at the sea, and so on and so on. That sounds like prosperity theology to me, doesn't it, you? Let me just say this. Jesus said, "What shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul?" God is concerned with our spiritual well-being. He's not concerned so much with our bank account. I read that during World War II, a U.S. Marine was separated from his unit on a Pacific island. Fighting had been intense, and in the smoke and in the crossfire, he lost touch with his comrades, and alone in the jungle, he heard the enemy soldiers coming in his direction, so he scrambled for cover. He ran up a ridge, and he saw some cave openings. And he made his way inside of one of those caves. He felt safe for a moment, but he knew that once they began looking for him, it would just be a matter of time before they found him and killed him. He was a religious individual, and so he began to pray to the Lord and ask the Lord to please protect him. He said, "Whatever you do, I will trust you." After praying, he lay quietly listening as he heard the enemy begin to draw close. He thought, "Well, I guess the Lord isn't going to help me get out of this one." few moments later, he saw a rather large spider at the opening of the cave. The spider began to make its way and began to weave a web. He thought, well, this is just great. I need a brick wall. And the Lord sent a spider. God must have a sense of humor, he thought. As the enemy drew closer, he watched from the darkness of his hideout. He could see them searching one cave after another. As they came to his cave, he got ready to make his last stand. But to his amazement, after glancing in the direction of the cave, the soldiers moved on. Suddenly he realized that the spider web over the entrance, it looked like that nobody had entered that cave any time recently. And so he said to the Lord, I had forgotten that with you a spider's web is stronger than a brick wall. Now, I have no idea if that's a true story. I'm not suggesting, even if it was, that was some act of God in and of itself. I have no idea. It's not my business. It's above my pay grade. I do know that it's clear that God has done such things, revealed in the Bible, not necessarily a spider's web per se. Dream of the Midianite soldier that Gideon overheard in the book of Judges. Deep sleep that God brought on Saul and his men to protect David from harm in 1 Samuel. Long list of things like that. As long as we think that we can handle things on our own, we have no need for God. As long as we think that we have to be in charge, we're not ready to submit to God. There have been a lot of great people, powerful, wealthy people, who've had to learn to depend on God. The very Son of God himself committed himself to dependence upon the Father. He said, not my will, but your will be done. So we might say, who do we think we are to refuse to, if you will, let Jesus take the wheel, to refuse to submit to God and to trust him to take care of us? That doesn't necessarily mean he's going to work every little thing out just the way that we want it. If you're a parent, you know that you don't, hopefully, don't do everything that your children want and give them everything that they want, but you have their best interest in mind. Sometimes that's why you deny them things. Jesus said in Matthew 6, 25 through 34, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you, not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Fact is, I am dependent upon God, whether we acknowledge it or not. We may fight it, we may refuse to admit it, we may adamantly deny it. You may deny that you're a human being, as some people are doing that these days, I think. But it does not alter reality. But any time you deny reality, it comes at a terrible cost. And the cost of denying your dependence upon God will ultimately be the price of your soul. Maybe you need to make a decision this morning that requires putting your trust in the Lord, depending upon Him in a way that you've not been willing to do at this point. Let's stand together and sing the song. If you're subject in some way, please come forward.